Hello everyone, this is Yvonne for another episode of A to Easy, and this time we will be discussing about ACS. I know, another abbreviation, but it's an important one. So today we will be discussing about what ACS is, how to recognize it, and the management plan. But first, we have here with us...
Hi everyone, it's Sally again, a bit of a returning guest, but very excited to learn about ACS.
Okay, so ACS stands for Acute Coronary Syndrome. Coronary refers to the coronary arteries, which are perfusing the myocardium, which is a heart muscle. And ACS refers to acute myocardial ischemia. Ischemia means that there is not enough perfusion, and therefore there is a mismatch between the supply and demand. And or an infarction. Infarction is like blockage, which causes complete tissue hypoxia. And this can happen either to a partial or a complete occlusion of a coronary artery. And this ACS is an umbrella term for three entities, let's call them. First being unstable angina pectoris. Second being a non-ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. So an NSTEMI, or a STEMI, which is an ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. I'm gonna simplify that. So it's unstable angina, basically, an NSTEMI, which is a heart attack that doesn't have an ECG changes, and a STEMI.
Okay, I think I get that. So ACS, acute coronary syndrome, coronary is about the coronary arteries, it's about myocardial ischemia, and all of those things happen in these three entities, which is unstable angina, NSTEMIs, and STEMIs.
Perfect. Okay. So the way that ACS presents clinically is with your typical crushing central chest pain, often described as chest tightness, which may be relieved by rest or with nitrate use. So this classic crushing chest pain can radiate to your left jaw, neck, or your left arm. However, it can also present atypically, but that is for a different story itself. And then common additional symptoms that you'll have is your autonomic symptoms, such as sweating, nausea, vomiting. So this is what we're seeing, clammy, is your sweating patient. And classically, your typical patient will be an elderly, obese, male smoker, with a history of hypertension and diabetes, probably high cholesterol as well, which are all risk factors for ACS.
Okay, so in the exams and on the wards, my like typical patient would be an obese, elderly male, hypertension, diabetes, high cholesterol, and they're gonna be complaining of a crushing chest pain, but they might say it's like in their arm or their neck instead, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and then what do we do?
So it's important to also recognize that not everyone presents the classic way, so it's important to do these investigations probably with most people presenting with chest pain. And what these investigations are is a 12-lead ECG and laboratory tests, which are important diagnostic tools in the initial evaluation. First, to compare the three categories, angina pectoris is due to reduced perfusion, which does not cause necrosis, whereas NSTEMI and STEMI are in fact characterized by ischemic necrosis of the cardiac muscle, which results in elevated cardiac enzymes in the blood. These elevated cardiac enzymes are due to basically the cardiac myocytes dying, and they are releasing these enzymes to the blood, which we detect. So angina will not have any raised cardiac enzymes because there is no ischemic necrosis.
Okay, so that helps us rule out or rule in angina. But how do we then distinguish between NSTEMI and STEMI?
Here's where our ECG, our 12-lead ECG, comes. So both are MIs, so both are heart attacks, as the name suggests. And STEMI results in specific ECG changes, such as ST segment elevation, whereas NSTEMI will have raised cardiac enzymes, but no ST segment elevation. So an ACG is a very useful tool for ACS, and especially for STEMI, because you typically expect your peak T waves, ST elevation, and then subsequently you may see some pathological Q waves, which are after your T waves, and T wave inversion. So what are pathological Q waves, you may ask?
Yeah, I have no idea. Please tell me.
Yeah. Normal Q waves indicate the beginning of ventricular depolarization. Depolarization signifying the contraction of the ventricles. So if you look at the image we have on the description, it is the first downward line of your QRS complex. So it is pathological when it's more than 40 milliseconds, which is one small box, so it is wider than it's supposed to, or when it's deeper than usual, which is usually more than 25% deeper from your R wave. Your R wave is the upward deflection. It's also important to know that pathological Q waves can persist chronically, indicating myocardial scarring. So someone who has had a STEMI, you might see on a later ECG after like a few months, pathological Q waves. So it's important to make note of that, so you don't assume that whenever you see pathological Q waves, you think that the patient is having an MI now. And STEMI can also show some ECG changes and even ST depression, but will never show ST elevation because the definition of a STEMI is that the ST segment is elevated.
Okay, so ECG shows ST segment elevation for STEMI and no ST segment elevation for NSTEMI. And with STEMI, you might also get these pathological Q waves, which are wider or deeper than normal, but they don't always happen, and they can also be an indication of something that's happened in the past. This actually happened to me. I was in GP, and a patient came in, had to have a routine ECG, and he had pathological Q waves. But turns out he'd had a heart attack quite a while ago, but the GP kind of showed me them and taught me through them, and it was really good learning. So yeah, I've seen it. I can verify this is true information, everybody.
It is very true, and it's important to like know that. So yeah, we can learn some more information from our ECG in case we have a STEMI. So we can detect which coronary artery is blocked from an ECG, a STEMI ECG. And I will attempt to simplify this. So we have the right coronary artery, which supplies the inferior myocardial wall. And then we also have the left coronary artery, which has two main branches that you need to know, which is the LAD, L-A-D, which is the left anterior descending. And this supplies the anterior septal and anterior apical myocardial wall. So basically the front of the wall of the heart. And then we also have the left circumflex artery, which supplies the anterior lateral, so the side part of the heart, let's say. And damage to one of these arteries results in a very specific pattern on our ECGs. So if we have damage to the anterior myocardium, we will have ST elevation of V1 to V6. And there's a mnemonic to help you with that, which is SAL. Because septal, S, is V1 and V2. Apical, which is basically the end downward beat of the heart, is V3 to V4. And then lateral is V5 to V6. So SAL for septal is V1, V2, apical V3, V4, and lateral V5, V6. So basically the septum is applied by LAD and apex is applied by the distal LAD. Therefore, if we have a damage to our left anterior descending artery, you would expect an elevation to V1, V4. Whereas the proximal left circumflex artery will result in an increase in V5 and V6, and the lateral wall infarction due to the blockage of the lateral circumflex results in ST elevation for AVL and LID1. Okay, I'm gonna summarize that. LAD, V1 to V4, left circumflex artery, V5, V6, AVL, and LID1. Okay, following, we have now the inferior infarct, which is simpler, so sorry about the detailed explanation, whereas we have an ST elevation in LID 2, 3, and AVF. Okay, and because all of this can seem very hard to understand from someone speaking to you, we have an image on our description that you can see.
Okay, yeah, I feel like that would be really helpful. But just to break it down one more time. So we've got anterior infarcts, lateral infarcts, and inferior infarcts. And we can see these differently on ECG because they cause elevation in different leads. So anterior, you've got obstruction to the LAD, and that causes ST elevation in V1 to V4. A lateral infarct is obstruction to the circumflex artery, and that causes ST elevation of V5, V6, lead 1, and AVL. And then inferior infarcts blocks the right coronary artery, and this results in elevation of lead 2, 3, and AVF. Yvonne, though, I'm worried because I think there's one more. What about like a posterior infarct? I've heard of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, there is one more.
no.
Luckily, Sally Oak like summarizes perfectly for the previous three we discussed. But we have a posterior infarct. A posterior infarct is due to the obstruction of the posterior descending artery. And that usually, on normal ECG, presents as an ST depression of V1 to V3. So if you have your normal ECG and you see an ST depression of V1 to V3, always think that might be a posterior infarction.
Okay, that's good to know. Can we leave ECGs for the moment and go back to the cardiac biomarkers? Because you said that, both NSTEMIs and STEMIs have a change in cardiac biomarkers. But what are these? What are we looking at?
So recap, unstable angina, no changes in cardiac biomarkers. But as you said, STEMI and NSTEMI, we have a rise in cardiac biomarkers. Those are typically troponins. So you'll hear people like, oh, what about the CHOP? Troponins usually rise around 6 hours after the onset of the myocardial infarction. And they peak around 12 to 24 hours. Usually, typically 12, but there is a range there. And the degree of increase usually correlates to how big the infarct is. So if you have like lots of the myocardium dying, obviously more of those enzymes from the dying cardiac myocytes will be released to circulation so we can count them, okay? There is also another biomarker, which is our creatine kinase MB, CKMB. But it has been superseded by troponins in clinical practice, so you will rarely find it in clinical practice. It's just more for book kind of like references.
Yeah, I feel like we got taught about it in year 2, but you're right. Like, yeah, I haven't ever seen it used clinically. So we always check for troponins. Any other investigations we should do?
So following that, if you have raised troponins and you have your ECG changes or no ECG changes, typically, the patient is taken for a coronary angiography, which can be used, which is the best test for definitive diagnosis. What happens with coronary angiography, coronary angio, is when you put a contrast dye and radiography is used to assess the degree that your coronary artery is blocked.
Okay, so we can do that to establish someone's having an MI, but then what do we actually do to treat the MI?
So the primary intervention, so what you happen as soon as you pick that up, can be remembered by the mnemonic MONA. You'll hear that a lot. It will stay with you for life. MONA, okay? So what does it stand for? It stands for morphine, which you give for pain relief. Someone is in pain. Oxygen, which you only give if they have low SATs. I know it's in the mnemonic, but you only give it if they have all low SATs, usually lower than 92%. You give nitrates, which can be given either sublingually, so below the tongue, or IV. And then A stands for aspirin, which is typically 300 milligrams chewing, which is an antiplatelet.
And is that for all three conditions, angina, NSTEMI, and STEMI?
Yes. You can give this for your unstable angina and your STEMIs and NSTEMIs. For STEMI specifically, and NSTEMI, we need immediately revascularization. Revascularization means means again, and vascularize to make sure that the heart receives blood supply. So we rush the patient to the cath lab. It's very important. We send the patient to the cath lab. We need to save their lives. And we go for the emergency coronary angio to detect which exact artery is blocked. And then you use percutaneous coronary intervention aka PCI. So PCI is what you're gonna hear, but it stands for percutaneous coronary intervention. Basically, they just stick wires through your arteries and go to the coronary arteries and just put a stent on block. But that's for cardiologists, not for year three students. So a PCI must be performed within 90 minutes of symptom onset. So that is the ideal case scenario. If a PCI cannot be performed, so for example, the way I was, because I'm on cardiofem right now, the way I was described this is, if you are in the middle of nowhere and there's not a cath lab anywhere near you and there is no other option, that's the only time you'll consider it, otherwise cath lab PCI. But the alternative is thrombolytics such as alteplase or streptokinase should be given. And emergency coronary bypass surgery is an option, but it's rarely used if PCI is not technically possible. So it is an option, but nowadays very, very difficult to happen. I guess if all like three main arteries are blocked and there is no alternative, then you will go for an emergency coronary bypass.
Okay, so that makes sense. So basically PCI is what we want ideally, and that needs to be within 90 minutes. Thrombolysis is another option, but like very secondary to PCI. And in the olden days, emergency coronary bypass surgery used to be a thing. Any contraindications to the thrombolytics though? Because I remember from stroke, they're pretty dangerous drugs, right?
Yeah, they're quite dangerous, because thrombolytics basically means that you don't allow the blood to clot. And it needs to clot for a reason. Anyhow, I'm not going to dwell too much into that, but if they had any previous intracranial bleeding, any ischemic stroke within the past 3 months, a really high blood pressure of like 180 over 110, any known coagulopathy, so which is basically problems with the clotting, and if it's more than 24 hours since onset symptom, ideally you should thrombolyze within like 3 to 12 hours. But if it's anything like more than 24, you would never ever consider it.
Okay. And then if neither PCI or thrombolytics are indicated,
then we have our CABG, which is CABG, which stands for coronary artery bypass grafting, and it's an open heart surgery. So that's an alternative.
Okay, so apart from these like big interventions, these definitive ones, do we give anything else at the same time?
So there is more to be given, unfortunately. Well, fortunately for our patients, to be fair.
Yeah.
So we give dual antiplatelets. That's something you'll definitely hear quite a lot. Dual, so that means two antiplatelets. So we already mentioned one antiplatelet, which is
aspirin.
Yeah. But we add a second one. Classically, it used to be clopidogrel. But now, more likely, the newer medication, ticagrelor.
Oh, I've heard of that. Ticagrelor, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's different between different trusts, but I think ticagrelor is getting quite popular. So don't just say cloppy and assume that you're done. Remember that there is another option. So after the initial loading dose, which is usually 300 milligrams for aspirin and cloppy, and 180 milligrams for ticagrelor. After you give that, which is basically when the patient is having a heart attack, you need to be giving a daily dose of 75 milligrams. Should be continued. It can be continued for your second antiplatelet, so your cloppy or your ticagrelor. It can be used for 1 month to 12 months. It depends on like the patient, but it's quite a while usually. And if you're using ticagrelor, it's a different dose. It's 90 milligrams. So for clopidogrel, it's 75. For ticagrelor, is 90 milligrams twice daily. And that's given, as I said, 1 to 12 months, depending on the case. However, aspirin is usually for life. So 75 milligrams aspirin is given for life if you have a PCI. We also have beta blockers and anticoagulations such as low molecular weight heparin is also recommended for someone having an MI. That's quite a lot.
That is quite a lot. Let me just try and summarize. So if someone's having a STEMI, then we're aiming for PCI, alternatively thrombolysis and CABG are options.
Mm.
Along with that, in the acute presentation of the STEMI, we need to make sure they get 300 milligrams of aspirin and then either 300 milligrams of clopidogrel or 180 milligrams of ticagrelor as like a stat dose. And that needs to be then followed up. You have aspirin for life, and that was a dose of 75 milligrams?
75 milligrams.
Okay. Then you have your antiplatelet, your either your clopidogrel, your ticagrelor for 1 to 12 months post your STEMI, depending on the situation of the patient. But just remember, we need an aspirin and we need another antiplatelet as well. And then, as you said as well, we also need a beta blocker and probably some low molecular weight heparin there too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all for STEMI. What about unstable angina and NSTEMI? Because that's different, right?
Yeah. So, I mentioned before a mnemonic Mona. Well, it's not just Mona, it's Mona Bash.
Okay.
That's a typical mnemonic. You definitely go through medical school listening to these mnemonic at least once. And it's actually quite useful. So Mona, as we said, stands for morphine, oxygen if required, nitrates and aspirin. Aspirin reminds us of the dual antiplatelet therapy. And then BASH stands for beta blockers, A for ACE inhibitors, S for statins. And all of these are to reduce risk factors, so like hypertension and like hypercholesterol. So these reduce the risk factors for another MI. And also H, our last letter, is heparin, which is for anticoagulation. And revascularization at a later point, so it's not an emergency, so you don't need to rush this person to a cath lab, but revascularization should be considered depending on the degree of obstruction. You will never, ever, ever give fibrinolytics in these patients.
Okay, so when we're thinking about NSTEMI and unstable angina, we're thinking Mona, BASH.
Yeah.
And you may need to revascularize them, so do PCI at a later date, but it's definitely not needed as acutely as a STEMI.
Yeah.
Lastly, tell me about complications then of ACS, because I feel like we always get asked about that.
There are a number of complications. I'm not going to go into too much detail about them because I think that's way too much info overload.
We covered a lot.
It's a big topic. So, complications include congestive heart failure. So basically, if you think about it, a part of your heart muscle was damaged, so your heart is going to have a few problems, so it might start failing you. Maybe we can have papillary muscle rupture. Papillary muscle is kind of supporting your valves, so that usually causes in mitral regurgitation.
Oh, that makes sense, because suddenly the valve is unsupported.
Yes, exactly. Okay, cool. So you might have arrhythmias.
Some of the muscle has died, so it can't conduct properly.
Yeah, especially with right coronary artery, which supplies the sinoatrial and AVN node, because it's the right part of the heart, then you're more likely to get arrhythmias, actually.
That's so clever.
You might have pericarditis, which is inflammation of the pericardial sac. And then you might have also sudden cardiac death. But I think that's enough to remember. So heart failure, papillary muscle rupture, mitral regurg, arrhythmias, pericarditis, and death.
Okay.
All pretty serious complications.
Yeah, very serious complications. And is there anything else we need to know on?
Yes, this is the last bit. So hang on, it's like a few more seconds. So it's not too much, but it's probably worthwhile to consider secondary prevention. So as future doctors, not quite there yet, it's also quite important to think how we prevent this from happening again. We mentioned the lifelong aspirin and dual antiplatelet for 12 months. Beta blockers is used to prevent the myocardial demand. So because you stop the heart from beating too fast, then the demand will never go too high for your coronary arteries to not be able to handle that. And then we mentioned statins, which are to prevent high cholesterol, which is responsible for the atheromatous formation, which causes the thrombus. And then we have ACE inhibitors and ARBs, which have been shown through evidence to reduce future events. And then apart from that, which is what we can give in terms of medications, it's really, really important to advise on healthy lifestyle And that really depends on the individual and whether they need to lose weight, whether they need to exercise more, whether they need to eat certain kind of diet. So don't forget that it's not all about drugs. It's also about your general like health as well.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. And this, I suppose, is more now the domain of the GP, isn't it? This is like primary care follow-up.
Yeah.
So just to ensure that we minimize the risk of any ACS ever happening again to this patient, lifelong aspirin. You need your antiplatelet for probably 1 to 12 months, nearing 12. Beta blockers, which reduces demand. Statins to reduce atheroma formation. ACE inhibitors or an ARB, which has been shown, yeah, to also minimize risk and generally look at the patient's lifestyle. Does that sound about right?
Yes, perfect. Thank you very much.
Hey everyone, this is Harry, and this is your 30-second summary on ACS. ACS stands for acute coronary syndrome and is an umbrella term for unstable angina, NSTEMI, and STEMI. Commonly, patients present with central crushing chest pain, which radiates to the jaw, neck, or left arm. Investigations show an increase in troponin for both NSTEMI and STEMI, with STEMI also demonstrating ST segment elevation on an ECG. In an acute setting, the patient is treated with morphine, nitrates, and dual antiplatelets, and PCI should be performed within 90 minutes of first medical contact for anyone diagnosed with STEMI. Thanks for listening.